Hello, this is The Leg Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel Problem Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show. Or maybe you're thinking about it. I don't know. This is probably a commercial. You want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out at www.linuxshow.com for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
I was looking up the number.
And
I'm sorry, there is no answer.
Oh, well, this is the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show. No answer. How bizarre. Little unusual phone conversation just as we hooked up the server. Well, we're back. It's Tuesday night. It's 8 o'clock here in Aurora, and we're broadcasting another exciting episode of the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show for June the 25th, 2002. We've
leave at 3 a.m. tomorrow to fly to New York, so I'm on the road again.
God's death, why so early?
Yeah, well, it's actually on a... on a bit of a geek pack mission. I'm going to speak to a group called E the People in New York. And
I've heard of them.
Yeah, go to the E the People site, and there's an invite there. There's a little cover charge going in. I don't know what I'm going to say yet, but it's going to be there. It's going to be in New York City someplace.
What is the URL?
It's E, just like it sounds, E the People. Let me look it up while we're talking.
E the People.org.
.org. It was formed out of another organization called Quorum, and I think this one, I forget the names of both organizations, but I've been in touch with the Quorum guys for a couple of years now. They're trying to do a lot of the right things. Their slogan is Democracy is a Conversation, which I think is cool, needless to say. And they're, you know, they're, let's see if they have something on the...
Democracy is a Conversation. Boy,
yeah.
Where have I heard that before, huh?
Yeah, well, it should be up here somewhere. Anyway, keep checking back. It's going to be in New York. It's going to be Thursday, and it's going to be there in a big new event that they're having. Anyway, it's kind of a launch event. So I'll figure it out before we're out of the show.
Cool. Don't forget to plug the AOTC and GeekPack website.
Oh, that's
the whole deal. They will be up by Thursday.
Oh, really?
So,
wonderful.
At least something will be there by Thursday. So go ahead and plug them. At least
okay.
We'll
I
be ready to be taking money on Thursday. That's for sure. Well, that's good. I'm excited that you've got. Although I'm not, it's not cool to be on the road again. Geez, you just got back from Europe, but at least it's for a good cause.
Right.
What the
right.
heck?
Yeah. They actually, if you hit, yeah, I think that's it. If you hit About E the People under Democracy is a Conversation, that link, I think, takes you there. And they have a nice little list of virtues, authenticity over rhetoric, curiosity over bias, ideas over spin, listening over yelling, people over demographics, that kind of thing. So,
yeah,
that's cool.
It's reading like a clue chain rebuttal.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Which is good.
Which is good. I was reacting to somebody wrote to me today saying that all the top brass at Apple have been reading Clue Train and were directing a company based on it. I don't think that's the case. I actually think that's phone call inflation across a series of people from one conversation I may have had and shared with somebody in England that kind of spread. But
Doc, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exaggeration is, too.
Yeah, there you go. So.
And lying's even better.
Yeah.
So, I heard Arnie talking. Arnie, you're here.
Yeah.
How are things in Southern California this evening?
Kind of muggy and hot. It's just getting very muggy and hot these days. It's like what they call here is the June gloom. In the morning, it's really humid and overcast, and then it gets real hot in the afternoon, and by that time, it still hasn't dried out, so it's kind of damp. And sticky, so I'm gonna try to stay cool.
Well, do so, Russ. How are things out on the eastern half of the country?
Well, strangely enough, it is muggy and hot, just like Arnie's reporting. In fact, I just noted just before we went on the air that we had an August supply of lightning bugs outside. Normally, they really tend to hit end of July, beginning of August, and we can see their little bodies lighting up as they dance around in the evening. But, man, oh, man, there was a ton of them out there tonight. So, I don't know. I guess summer has arrived early in the Washington, D.C. area.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, anecdotally, a very interesting sort of geek sort of thing is there's a little town quite a ways south of where Kevin and I are right now called Lincoln, Illinois. In fact, there's about five towns in Illinois named Lincoln, Illinois, but this one is on Highway 55, so it's pretty easy to find. But Lincoln, Illinois owns the distinction of being the lightning bug capital of the entire world. There's a couple of swamps that sort of ring the town, and these swamps, there's something about the pH of the swamp that makes this ideal lightning bug breeding grounds, and it's really cool to drive by Lincoln, Illinois at night because you can hit so many lightning bugs that you can turn your lights off and actually see with just the squished bodies of lightning bugs all over your car. But very geeky sort of thing.
And it's really great when you're when a lightning bug hits your windshield at night, and then you have to squirt the windshield, and it smears the lightning bug all over the place, and then for the rest of the evening, your windshield glows, fluoresces with this light pale green.
Yeah, it's actually very cool. But Kevin,
not for the lightning bug, though.
Yep, not for the lightning bug. But Kevin and I are here in Aurora, Illinois, broadcasting live, high atop the broadcasting facilities of GeekCast here in Aurora, Illinois, bringing you another show live. I'd like to do a little sort of housekeeping before we go too much further into the show. First off, number one is, a couple weeks ago, I made an announcement that the Linux show looked like we were going to be broadcasting from Linux World Expo. Well, they have since called us back and uninvited us.
Oh, God.
So we are not going to be broadcasting from the Linux World Expo. Not to worry, Doc. Apparently, Bruce Perrin has lined us up a card table for GeekPack. We still need to figure out a way to get out there, but we just won't be broadcasting, that's all. But there's that. And the other thing is a couple weeks back I announced that periodically during the course of the summer we were going to be taking a week here and a week there off. Kevin and I do take vacations from time to time. And one of the weeks we like to take off is next week, the first week of July. Not necessarily to travel, but because we like to make total pigs out of ourselves. Next week, I'm sure the same thing is true everywhere all over the country, but next week here in the Chicago area, there are so many fests. Taste of this, taste of that, you name it. There's a taste of it here in Illinois. And so I'm going to be spending the majority of next week traveling from Ribfest to Ribfest, spending my time pigging out for the entire week.
Frozen cheesecake on a stick.
Yeah, cheesecake on a stick, you bet.
And lots of tequila, hey Jeff?
Beer and roast corn, that's right. So we will not be broadcasting next week because we're going to be traveling around having some fun during the course of next week. So make sure you mark on your calendars that next week, which is August the 2nd, we will not be July the 2nd, we will not be broadcasting, but we will be back on July the 9th for our regular Tuesday night show. So make sure that you mark that down. Tentatively scheduled for that July the 9th show is Cameron Cooper from Fat Linux making up for his getting lost on an island 2 weeks ago. So we will be inviting him back to try and put together the Fat Linux segment. But let's go ahead and jump right into the show. Tons of big stories to talk about tonight. So let's not waste any time. Arnie, do you have a hot story of the week?
Yeah, there's a couple of good ones. Let me see if I can. I've got 500,000 Windows on my, as usual, running E, and I've got, I don't know, so many browser windows up, I can't find the ones I'm looking for. Yes, Linux Weekly News featured a story the last couple of days, actually I think this one hit today, about Kodak turns to IBM and Linux for digital cinema. And what this is really, really interesting. It's, yes, Ziff Davis, it's another fork in the kernel. And this fork is called the Cinema Operating System. It's based on the Linux kernel. It will provide the digital backbone, not for movie production, but for movie projection. And this will be the digital backbone for movie theaters. So here's another aspect of the entertainment industry that's going to be running on Linux. It's going to be open source. And this is open technology so that the movie, the cinema, the theater owners can actually take control of their own production as far as the trailers and presenting advertisements and stuff like this. And, you know, this is just another example of the right hand not knowing what the left hand's doing. Here we have the movie industry and the multi-billion dollar corporations that form the movie industry doing everything they can to undermine Linux and to undermine open technologies. And here they are right in their back door. It's leaking its way into their business as well. I mean, it's already doing all the rendering on many of the movies that are digitally rendered. And now, also, it's going to be projecting their movies.
Yeah, it's a follow-up to last week's Disney announcement.
Yeah.
The irony keeps on really presenting itself in a stark way. I have to go back 2 years ago to Doc, you can correct me when these comments were first being quoted, because you started making a lot of them a couple of years ago. Oof. That Linux was quickly turning into lumber and nails.
It's pure infrastructure.
And as that trend would continue, that Linux would turn into lumber and nails, it would quietly become pervasive across the industry and quietly dominate. Rather than world domination from a revolution, it would just quietly work its way through as a commodity.
I like to think of it as seeping in from the bottom, like from the basement, seeping into the basement and kind of getting into the infrastructure of the system.
From the leaks in the infrastructure.
It's a very subversive technology, Linux is, because it's open and
kind of like termites.
Termites. And it just kind of takes over, you know?
Yeah, I think, I've just been writing about this, but I think that what's happened is that Linux has taken the lead in commoditizing, not just sort of commoditizing the operating system, but really commoditizing Unix. So what's happened is that at its base, we've got all these other operating systems that are sort of conspiring along with Linux to undermine Windows, quite frankly. So, you know, at a command line level, Linux and BSD and OS X and Solaris are not significantly different. If you're a Unix expert, it's not a problem to shift from one to the other and to develop cross-platform applications for those. And that's happening with Star Office. It's happening with Zimian. Zimian's got a very interesting thing happening this week. But I don't want to get a jump on what I'm saying. But anyway, it's sort of like Linux has finally delivered on the Unix promise of long ago. And it's pretty hard for everybody else to cope with.
Yeah, and hopefully they're not. Hopefully they'll just cope with it the way that they should cope with it, and that is just accept it where it is, and without any of these preconceived notions. I mean, I would be very happy if Linux was just accepted as Linux. I mean, just for what it is, and that is a pretty stable, darn reliable and stable program platform. And, you know, that's that, I'd be happy if it, and it looks like that's what it's doing. The other story I had was on Slashdot today, and this one, I just really like the title of it. Shocked. I'm shocked at Payola. And this plays right into one of the other topics tonight we're going to talk about. And apparently what's happening is, of course, we all knew what was happening. But, you know, just like in the 1950s when the Payola scandal was hit the radio business, apparently that, you know, hey, if you want to get played on normal channels, on normal radios, and, of course, you know, that means if you want to get played on a Clear Channel station, which is all but owns music radio these days, you're going to have to hit, you know, grease the palms a little bit. And, you know, this really, really does connect to the CARP stuff, because this is just more of the same multi-billion-dollar corporations extorting money from people who can't afford it.
It has interesting timing, if nothing else.
Oh, yeah. I think this needs to get more headlines so that people realize the same people who are shoving CARP down our throats, CARP crap down our throats, are the same people who are begging multi-million dollar payola from performers. And, you know, and of course, you know, these performers don't have much of a choice, because if they want to be played, they're going to have to pay the money. Okay, now, with free broadcasting via the Internet, they have to stop this. They have to stop it, because that cuts off the cash cow of the payola. All right?
Well, yeah.
Cutting that off, you know, if you can get some congressmen to sponsor CARP legislation, you know, or in this case, just sponsor CARP law, CARP policy.
Let's save this for the second half of
the
show today, okay?
Yeah, but that was a very interesting story to me.
Did they hear the term CARP blanche? I was just wondering if that's useful.
I love it. I love it. Kudos to you, Doc.
Yeah.
Do you have another story, Arnie?
No, that's it.
Okay.
Those two big ones.
Okay, Doc, go ahead.
Boy, we actually have too many stories tonight. One is, and there were two pieces in yesterday's Wall Street Journal in the marketplace section. One refers to Microsoft's new Palladium, and I just suggest people go to Google and look up Palladium. That's with two L's, P-A-L-L-A-D-I-U-M. If you go look up Palladium on Microsoft's site, you won't find it. It got leaked very purposefully and very skillfully to Stephen Levy at Newsweek, so it ran on both MSNBC and on the Newsweek site, and a few other selected other places. And basically, this is Microsoft's sort of partly software and partly chip-based, and get this, open-source security strategy. And basically, they're trying to drive some infrastructure here where they get to own some of it and not own some other of it. And my friend Eric Norlin at who writes for Digital ID World. If you go to Digital ID World and look it up, he has a really interesting analysis of it called the $283 billion something or other. But in it, he's basically saying that long run, what Microsoft is doing in some ways is ceding the enterprise to Linux, and in order to maintain its margins, goosing a whole new generation of PCs with this stuff built in. Clipper chips, sort of. Of course, they have to get AMD to buy into it, and they have to get Intel to buy into it, which is a long shot, to say the least. But basically, they want to restart the PC business and have DRM built into it and a whole bunch of other stuff that kind of makes us ill to think about. But anyway, that's the strategy. It's called Palladium, and it's one more thing for the geeks to chew on. And so that's the first piece of news. And next to it in the Wall Street Journal is a piece called New Microsoft Pricing Looms. And it's all about, guess what, you know, Linux, basically. But Microsoft has set the clock to up their prices on all kinds of huge contracts with enterprises at the end of July, which Zimian has creatively called Y2Pay Day. And if you go to the Zimian site and click on the Y2Pay link, you'll find that they are offering huge discounts, and they have deals in the works, supposedly. You know, just one paragraph from the journal because of expected price increases from longtime customers are considering competing products such as the Linux operating system and Sun Microsystems Star Office, which competes, blah, blah, blah. But here's a cool thing. The chief information officer of one large European financial concern who declined to be named for fear of raising Microsoft's ire said he was, quote, 70% sure, unquote, his firm would start moving its more than 30,000 computer desktops to Linux-based software made by a company called Zimian instead of re-signing with Microsoft, even if the systems might crash more often. It's not sure what that means, that last line, but there it is. And Zimian, of course, has this promo going. The piece goes on to say that basically, you know, this is going to be a net gain for Microsoft because most people are going to sign back up at the higher rates, and their stock will go up and all
well,
of
the I think there should be some promotion on the open source side, but it's interesting that you said, what is it you said, financial corporation?
Yeah.
You know, this is like connects with the story I've been connecting with in the news the last few weeks, and there's been a lot of this story of financial services switching to Linux.
Yeah, I wonder. Well, the thing is that again, it's pure infrastructure. You know, there. If you want the cheapest possible hardware and you don't want the complications of all this licensing, it's kind of a no-brainer.
And a lot of them have mainframes anyway.
Yeah. Well, here's another one. There's a company called Fidelia, F-I-D-E-L-I-A. I spent a lot of time talking to yesterday, and they're doing high-end enterprise performance management software. This is like network management, like OpenView, that kind of thing, Tivoli that HP and IBM do, only they do performance management over a longer period of time with record keeping and databases and all the rest of it. And they're open sourcing a bunch of stuff, and they're, you know, got proprietary stuff in there too. And an interesting thing too is that a lot of their XML communications internally run on Jabber, just pro forma. There it is, you know. But in any case, they're a big enterprise play. And what they're saying, what they told me yesterday, is that most of their new customers are running on Linux. And they're running a lot of boxes on Linux. And most of them, of course, are you know, white boxes of one kind or another. They don't even know or care what kind they are.
Yeah, I see. So, these are the type of companies that have their own software development people.
Right.
And that's where you're going to see Linux go in first, anyway.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are standalone applications like that, and then there are ones that are ported over, you know, like Oracle. I mean, if your whole thing is nothing but Oracle, well, why not run on Linux? Your hardware is going to be cheaper.
Sure.
So that's just sort of...
And your licensing.
Yeah, that's sort of spreading out. The third thing, and it's a very brief one, is, if, again, it was mentioned on Slashdot, and it's this issue called war chalking, and I was there. Once again, this is something that came out of this bar event that happened in England when I was over there. Getting Matt Jones, whose site is blackbeltjones.com, who's the chief, I think, information architect. I think the chief architect, anyway, of BBC Interactive. A really cool guy, fun guy. He's created basically a pattern or design language for walking around a city and publicly marking all of the Wi-Fi base stations that are within laptop shot of where you might be standing. And so, and it's one to mark a closed site that's a circle, and an open one looks like two half circles facing outward. Anyway, war chalking is based on war walking or war driving, which is derived from war games, but basically stands for wireless access reconnaissance. So that's what I did, without knowing that's what I was doing a couple weekends ago in London, and it just coincidentally, Matt showed me that at the bar in London, and now it's on Slashdot, and it's number one on Daypop, and a bunch of other things. Just a fun thing to check out. So everything else is CARP after that.
Okay. Well, then you can save up the CARP stories.
A lot of shit about CARP.
Well, good, because I got quite a bit myself. Russ, what's your hot stories of the week?
Well, I got a couple of short ones, at least. One is the release over at desktoplinux.com about Windependence Day on July 4th.
Oh, I love it.
Where they're actually holding a contest where people can write in 500 to 1,000 words word account on how they've kicked the Windows habit. And they're actually going to have many, many cool prizes. And if you go over to their site, they have... a list of many of these cool prizes. There's like about two dozen of them.
What's the URL?
Desktoplinux.com, and I think it's listed under their news or something like this. But it's interesting stuff. There's some interesting prizes and whatnot, software and T-shirts and you know, cool geek type stuff. So and there certainly seem to be enough slots so that if people want to join in and say what they've got to say, they got a chance to actually get something cool out of it. So I think that's a pretty neat thing. Just as a follow-up to one of the things that Doc was saying, where is that one? About the Palladium story. The Register, the infamous Register, apparently just put up a story just recently, like in the last couple hours or something, about this that I just saw as we went on the air, and it's a pretty heavy piece, but the title of it is MS to Eradicate GPL, Hence Linux.
And wow, I didn't see that one yet. That's interesting.
It looks very interesting. I only got part of the way through it. It's actually a pretty long piece here, but trying to analyze what exactly all this Palladium stuff will do if adopted. And I think I get the drift of what he's talking about, and this was something that concerned me when I had heard rumbles about this a couple months ago. So you may want to go over there. The first paragraph is absolutely marvelous. It says, yesterday, as we all know, Microsoft fed an exclusive story about its new Palladium DRM PKI trust machine to Newsweek hack Stephen Levy, a guy who writes without irony of high-level encryption, presumably because they trusted him not to grasp the technology well enough to question it seriously. So that's the way it begins. And
I don't think it's being fully fair to Stephen, because he had plenty of skepticism, at least in tone.
Well,
in the thing. He said either it's going to be a whiff or a hit out of the ballpark, and that was a setup for lots of people like me to come in and say, bet on the whiff.
Well, it looks like an interesting piece. I mean, I haven't gotten through it, but it's probably worth the time to go there and give it a look. Another thing is actually just a PR piece that I haven't heard anyone talk about anywhere, but it's an interesting one. Zimian, once again, says that a retail chain called Zumiez, and I've never heard of this chain, I presume it must be regional or something like this, has just done a Linux deployment for point-of-sale transactions in their 91 stores, and featuring Zimian Desktop, of course. And I think that's quite cool. Anytime we can get sort of a retail rollouts like that. And the other one that I've lost the link to, I think it's either on Linux Weekly News or actually I think I may have seen it on Slashdot on Sunday, about the Onto and Oak Vorbis getting together to do a type of video stream. It seems to me that there was one Emmett Plant involved in there, who I also believe...
Who?
I don't know, but it's some guy who seems to be lurking around the chat room, if you...
yeah, he's there.
If you look around, he is there. Unless he's bailed on me, he's there. Because I just got a quick note from him. But it was on my list of things to mention today. So I think we've got some interesting things going on out there today.
Yep, absolutely. Got any more stories, or is that it?
I think that's it for me.
Okay, I got a couple I'd like to come in here real quick with. I picked up this story off of, let's see, where did I bookmark this? Okay, yeah, itworld.com. I'm going to drop this one into the chat room. And story on itworld.com. And our devoted listener, NZ Heretic, out there, this is a story that takes place in New Zealand that's written about in IT World about a trade show, a community-based trade show that was held in the town of, and I'm going to botch this name, I know, it's Tauranga, New Zealand, a couple weeks back. And this was sort of a business club that was partnering with Microsoft to sponsor these company, business-to-business type little expositions where people could educate people about the types of their business. It's basically a Chamber of Commerce type event. In fact, one of the organizers of the event was the Tauranga Chamber of Commerce. And anyways, the story is that one of the marketing hacks, actually a fairly well-known marketing hack from Microsoft, because he used to be, and Doc, I know you've met this guy, he used to be one of the assistant VPs of marketing over at Corel, Warwick Gray, and he was in charge of their Linux effort. But anyway, so...
Yeah, sure, I've met him. He doesn't ring a bell.
Yeah, but I know I've met him. Because I remember meeting him at Linux World Expo because I was bitching at Corel for ripping off Fat Linux. Warwick saw a booth put up by a small company by the name of Bay PC Consulting. This is like a three-man business, and on their little tabletop display, they had stapled onto their little display a couple of newspaper clippings about some of the headway that Linux had made into the business marketplace over the last couple months. And the guy from Microsoft went and ripped the stuff off of the booth. And apparently he had two arguments that he used for ripping this marketing material down. And that it was unfair of the guys from Bay PC Consulting, again, a three-man company, to use marketing materials that were anti-Microsoft, and the focus of this expo was supposed to be educational and not competitive. Can you imagine the gall of this multinational, $100 billion corporation ripping stuff off of the booth of a three-man company? Now, I hope to hell there's plenty of lawyers in New Zealand that'll pick the call up for these guys, because these guys should sue Microsoft up one side and down the other.
And when they get through with Microsoft, they'll be able to pick the bones clean, too, I hope, one hopes.
But, the gall of doing this. And Microsoft said, well, we were the co-sponsors. We were certainly within our rights as co-sponsors. And that may, who knows, that may be legally true. I don't know what's in the contract that Microsoft had with the Tauranga Chamber of Commerce. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to... put our friend NC Heretic on the case, and I'm going to ask him if he can go ahead and contact these guys, seeing as he's a homie down there, and get the inside scoop for us and report back to us in 2 weeks on the plight of these poor guys from Bay PC. Actually, who knows? It could be that the PR that they're getting from Microsoft attacking them is doing them a world of good. Who knows? Sometimes negative publicity is the best type to get. I don't know. But it is 8:34 here in Aurora, Illinois. We're going to take a short break. We're going to come back with segment number two of the Linux Show. We're going to be talking about what else? CARP. I've got a lot to say about it. We'll start out with what's going on with the Linux Show website, why are the archives gone, and some other things that we'll talk about as soon as we get back. Everybody kick back and relax. We're going to take a short break. Kevin, have you got a free open source tune lined up for us to play?
No, we're just going to play some commercials.
Oh, commercials? Then we'll make it short. We'll be back in just a few minutes. You don't have Sounds of Slashdot available?
No.
I think we should all sing.
That's on MP3, ironically enough.
Okay, well, we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with the second half of the Linux Show. Everybody hang in there.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the sponsors who make the Linux Show possible. I'd like to thank VA Linux. Oops, no, they're not VA Linux anymore. They are now VA Software. Hope they don't change their name again pretty soon. I'm going to have to make another commercial. But check out VA Software and learn all about the SourceForge development platform for internal company development projects. Or if you're just a little guy but want to get a flavor of it all, check out SourceForge.net and spread the word on open source development platforms. So you need an email server, huh? Well, check out one of our sponsors. What? The Linux Show has sponsors? Yeah, well, how the hell do you think we pay the bandwidth bill around here? Well, it's really more the phone bill, not the bandwidth bill. Phone bill is killing us. But anyways, back to our sponsor. Check out the folks at www.littlebluebox.com and buy their stuff and sponsor.
And we're back.
This is segment number two of the Tuneless Linux Show tonight. Sorry, everybody, but it should be obvious to you right now that we're not playing music right at the moment. We will be playing music within the next couple of weeks by the time the show comes back on in 2 weeks, because we actually have had quite a few people who have come to us and offered us open source tunes that a website, so that other websites who then want to broadcast license-free music can copy our list and obtain the appropriate documentation they need to play the music as well. Anybody who is out there that manages a band or has a band that wants, you're a member of a band, you want some free publicity and you're willing to sign us license to your music, we'll be happy to play that music as well.
And needless to say, you actually have to still own the copyright to your music, which is kind of rare if you have a CD deal.
Yeah, yeah. That is the hitch. So the performers, they are coming to us, but so far they're coming to us, you know, slowly. We do have permission, and this is not going to be real great shakes, but we've got permission to use about one-third of the entire Roger Whittaker songbook.
I want to get some of him whistling.
Yes.
Yeah, he was an ace whistler.
Yes, he is.
Probably still is, for all I know.
Yeah, he is. In fact, Roger Whittaker is going to be playing a concert here in Aurora in, let me look at my list here. It's in October. And we are going to take advantage of Roger playing at a theater here in Aurora, Illinois. And he is going to do a announcement to the people at the concert about the issue of licensing in music, and we're going to actually be broadcasting his concert live from the Palace Theater in Aurora, Illinois, as part of an effort to help promote the cause of defeating or getting CARP put aside. And so that, I guess that's the entryway, the segue we're going to have into our discussion about CARP tonight. If anybody is completely unaware of what is going on with the issue of CARP, please go to our website, www.thelinuxshow.com. And right in the middle of the page for tonight's show, we have a link, www.copyright.gov/CARP/webcasting_rates_final.html. So it's a long URL. So go to our site, click on it, and it will bring you to the government's, the librarian of the Library of Congress's determination of what us webcasters should be required to pay to performance artists. Now, this is something new. First of all, let me set this in reference to people who are listening so that you all understand what's different about this. Number one, this is new. This has never been done before. In the past, the people who wrote the music collected a fee, a royalty fee, through BMI ASCAP. BMI ASCAP fees are required to be paid by all radio stations and by webcasters. It is a fair and reasonable fee. It costs us here at GeekCast less than $500 for an entire year.
And we don't broadcast a lot of music, but
Arnie, if we were to broadcast like five times as much music as we do, we would still fall under that $500 yearly minimum. The royalty fees for the writers are very reasonable. They're very fair for webcasters. And most of them are either based upon flat fees or upon a percentage of the revenue generation stream that is developed by the website. So if a website is a real low-volume website, you've got the opportunity of either paying the minimum fee, the $500 a year, or if you're actually making a little bit of money, but it's still, you know, not a gigantic amount. If you're doing, say, $6,000 to $10,000 a year, not what you would really call a going commercial entity, you can pay a fee that represents about the, depending upon the type of business you are, 7 to 10% of your net revenues. And so it's very reasonable. It's very fair. And the important thing is everybody pays the same kinds of schedules. Everybody is on an equal and fair playing field. All broadcasters are subject to this. This thing, though, with CARP, this most recent CARP, is a fee for performance artists, is not a fee for the person who created the intellectual property, and the fee is exclusive to only webcasting. And so broadcasters do not have to pay this fee at all. In fact, based upon the story that you were talking about earlier, Arnie, about the payola.
Mm-hmm.
There's two types of payola out there. There is illegal payola, and then there is legal payola. There is a standard play fee that radio stations can collect for positioning songs that are on the charts. And there's a good reason why when you go from radio station to radio station to radio station, regardless of what they may claim the format is, why all radio stations seem to play the same 30 or 40 songs. You go and listen to country western stations, you will hear an occasional pop music song. You go to a soft rock station, you will hear an occasional country music song. The reason why they do that is because the top 40 songs on the charts, on the combined chart, generate enormous volumes of cash for radio stations. This is a fact. So not only do they not have to pay this fee, they make money by playing the music. So it's a completely biased system. So that's the framework I've set it in. Okay, Doc, I know you've got a lot you want to talk about CARP, so why don't I jump over to you first?
Well, I didn't know where to begin. I've been working on a long piece for Linux Journal about it. The story just keeps compounding itself. I've come up with a series of metaphors. I mean, actually, I've unloaded them kind of on the blog in a not very organized way, but it has tripled my traffic incredibly. It's just huge. And because... there's not a single, as far as I'm concerned, there's not a single political philosophy that justifies this. This is absolutely and completely the execution of an entire business
by an entrenched establishment with the help of the government. And it's rekindled my my own interest in holding a tea party about this thing, because it's so freaking over the top. I think the reason we feel so betrayed, and the full story has not been told here, it's starting to come together a little bit, and I'm trying to find out more about it, and anybody wants to help me with it, I'm more than welcome to do so. I'm doc at ssc or doc at searles.com. A month ago, one of the registers of copyright, there are like 15 of these guys, okay, I think her name is Elizabeth Peters, issued an order, and it was called an order, rejecting the CARP's findings. It was summary. Everybody thought this was the end of the game, that sense had prevailed. And her boss, the Librarian of Congress, came in and essentially accepted absolutely everything, all of the thinking behind the CARP, and only adjusted some of the rates. That was it. And a process has been set forward that will, if it's carried out, and I don't think it will, but if it is carried out, will actually, you know, come after human beings and bankrupt them. I mean, the people who have been running radio stations on the Internet have been doing the best job of it. People like our friend Bill Goldsmith with Radio Paradise has been on here before. The people behind Soma FM in San Francisco, the people behind dozens of other stations, are going to be owing, you know, like large fractions of $1 million or perhaps more than that based on how many listeners they've had going back to 1998.
And some people do this as a hobby.
Some people do this as a hobby. They're doing it. It is good for the record industry. There's nobody who's any sense whatsoever who can at all look themselves in the mirror and say this has hurt the record industry at all. It hasn't. Nobody is busy, you know.
Oh, recording, saying that
digitally recording. I know people are saying it, but they're insane. I mean, the you know, there's nobody sitting. Very few people, if any, sitting there digitally recording these things and then redistributing them or denying anybody any income. And in fact, instead, what they're doing is exposing all kinds of artists in most cases, playing stuff that cannot be heard on the radio anywhere, that has no exposure otherwise. Anyway, I think that what we've got here is nothing less than the execution of an entire business category that has barely established itself. And I think they're doing it with what I think we need to characterize as a tax. This is a tax. This is taxation without representation, and it's a very, very big deal. It's a very big deal. I mean, these guys have operated in the dark for a long time, and I think they can get away with it, and they're not.
Yep. Doc, I've got an anecdotal number to give you. Now, this is based upon, I've been trying to get an actual number out of MTV Networks during the past couple of days,
mm-hmm.
on what the total number of listeners are, or I should say what the average number of listeners are per day for one single show, the Totally Request Live show, which is one of MTV's most popular shows. Okay, but this is one show, and if the anecdotal information that was given to me, because I have not gotten a quote out of MTV yet, but I am told that there are an average of 1.5 million kids a day that watch that show live. Now, it is rebroadcast a couple of times during the course of the evening, but during the live section...
So this is a webcast?
No, this is a live broadcast over cable TV.
Yeah, but that's exempt, is it not?
Yes, it is, but I'm trying to frame this in a reference.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm trying to frame this in a reference.
Mm-hmm.
And that if MTV had to pay the Royal TV for the single live broadcast of Totally Request Live,
mm-hmm.
it would cost them over $4 million a year,
mm-hmm.
to pay the royalties to the artist performance for that single show,
now
broadcast.
And here's what's really awful when you consider what's done with that money. From what I understand, and I'm subject to correction on this, the RIAA doesn't, you know, even though they're paying attention to they want every station to keep track of every single thing they play, they're not taking that money and routing it from the record that the station keeps to the artist that was played. They're putting it into a kitty, and then they're dividing it up based on the sales of of the records, meaning that Britney Spears and NSYNC and all those guys that internet radio doesn't play end up getting the money, or a lot of the money,
yep.
if it ever happens. Now, I may be wrong about how that works, because I'm not sure all of that has been worked out. But I'm looking right here. There's a really cool site called Digitally Imported. If you go to digitallyimported.org, I think it's .com. Anyway, Digitally Imported is mostly Linux, and they've got really cool statistics that are done by some Linux hacker over in Sweden that shows a daily graph of absolutely everything that the station is doing, or a series of stations are doing. I'm trying to go there and it's not taking. Oh, okay. Digitally Imported Radio, the best in European techno and trance on the net. Try to find techno and trance on the radio dial, even in New York City. You'll find it in London, all over the place, but you're not going to find it here. And it goes up to, they're getting 8,552. That's their max over the last 24 hours. And their trance station is number one, and their classical comes after that. Then Eurodance, hard trance, and hard house. This isn't my music, but who gives a crap? I mean, there are a lot of people, a lot of our listeners right here who love this stuff, and they're not getting it any other way. And the record companies presumably sell this stuff. I mean, it's incredible, absolutely incredible. But the interesting thing to me right now is that a lot of stations like Radio Paradise and KPIG and WXYC, Paul Jones, this is one of the stations Paul Jones hosts at iBiblio, are not rolling. They're not going off the air. They're not ceasing their streams, but many others are. And one of the things that I want somebody to do is to compile a list. And our friend Mary Wehmeyer, I know, is working on it. And she's a radio person. And there are some others, perhaps Kurt Hansen. KurtHansen.com is the radio. He's kind of the lead guy on fighting this thing. He has a newsletter and has a Save Our Streams site. And is a good resource on this. But this is the first time that that the bad guys have tried to shut a big hunk of the net down. And, it is being appealed. I don't know what the appeals process is on this. But there is an appeals process, so I don't think...
Who do you appeal to, though?
No, it's part of the same bureaucratic process.
You appeal to the same person who's made the decision?
No. I'm not sure.
You can go to the circuit court and get a stay on this.
Yeah, there are legal recourses, and this is going to take years to play out. And the brave among us, and I'm not going to knock the stations that are bagging it because they're doing it on good legal advice, very sound legal advice, and in many cases because they don't have the time or the energy to get involved in a legal proceeding or to have to keep the exposure, have dropped out. Some really good stations, but there are. Some that are staying with it, and more power to them. I hope our listeners listen around and drive those numbers up.
Yep, I hope so too. The initial feedback that seems to be coming through is that the some of the weakest players in terms that really could struggle by. In particular, what I'm getting at is college radio stations that have been amongst the real innovators over the course of the last couple of years are not going to be able to continue. Even though college radio stations do fall under the category of a not-for-profit organization, and their fees are a third of what a commercial entity would pay, it's still far more than a college radio station has got budgeted. College
mm-hmm.
radio stations barely exist, period.
Well, and most of them have, on their listening to their streams, unlike some of the ones like Digitally Imported and Radio Paradise that are really dedicated to what they're doing, it's a side thing for them. Paul was saying that WXYC, which is the very first station on the net, back in 1995, is generally running about 50 streams at any given time. And for some of those guys, it is a very diminished return to keep investing in that. They are actually well advised to just bag it for a while. And I mean, they have to put stations on the air anyway. They do have list. They have thousands of listeners locally. It's a grace note rather than a cause for those guys. It's not the whole tune. It's just a grace note in the chord of what they do. I wanted to add one other thing, and this is a really important one. Mark Cuban, who started Broadcast.com, sold it for like $6 billion to Yahoo. Sent an email to Kurt Hansen at his site that is now widely circulated. Our friend Jock Gill just sent it to us on one of our own mailing lists, and I put hooks of it up on my blog. But Mark, who famously owns the Dallas Mavericks too, by the way, and he's quite a character. He said that it's quite obvious that that this deal is based on the Yahoo. On a deal that Yahoo was going to make a few years ago when Mark was still there, the purpose of which was to avoid the revenue pricing and go with the kind of pricing that CARP settled on, simply because it was, in fact, Mark's strategy and Broadcast.com's strategy to drive the little guys out of business. And they had a business model planned for that involved a single webcast that would go out and then get distributed downstream. It was a multicasting idea that would be very much like broadcast. It wouldn't be separate streams sent out to many different people. It would be one stream. So they would be charged these ridiculous rates on one stream, essentially, that would get them fan out in all kinds of other ways. And they had all kinds of economies of scale planned with that. He left Yahoo and no longer guided this strategy. And then Yahoo basically was involved only nominally on the webcaster side, but really on the other side of this thing, as CARP put this deal together, in which they were trying to imagine what they called a willing buyer and a willing seller, which were the terms supplied to them by the DMCA a long time ago. And it's important to remember, as Kurt Hansen has pointed out, that as much as we may knock the DMCA, if you actually look at the DMCA's instructions to the CARP, they were not followed whatsoever. If they had been followed in reasonably at all, it would have been, something truly arbitrated would have emerged from this, not something that would have put most of the constituents on one side completely out of business. So anyway, Mark Cuban's thing is really interesting because it shows how they made the sausage. Very interesting.
Yeah. Also, the irony is that when this deal was first designed by Broadcast.com, the world was in general different then. Mark Cuba and the people at Broadcast.com were looking at a much higher stock value on their own than today. The combined stock value of both companies, Broadcast.com and Yahoo, put together, is worth today.
And remember that what in a typical dot-com fashion, what Mark was doing was imagining technologies that never happened.
Right.
Never happened.
So this deal was designed at the height of the dot-com boom before the bust happened. We were talking about $19.99, which were monopoly money back then, and so the prices people were willing to pay then were artificially inflated because everybody was basing their business models on these imaginary, well, we'll acquire the market now and make up our losses later in volume. And so the whole world was different. So here, this CARP, 3 years later, what I consider fraudulently, and I honestly consider this fraudulent, I think they took those numbers on purpose. They knew they were artificially inflated.
Well, they were listening. On one side, they're listening to a powerful lobbying and legal organization that's talking copyright, okay, that knows copyright. It's been, around copyright since forever. That's the RIAA people, and on one side, and those guys just kept hammering on copyright, yada yada yada. So what happened, I think, is that the the RIAA side of this thing kept the conversation entirely within the scope of strict copyright law, where the only interest worth considering was protecting the rights of the copyright holder, and to whatever extreme that was required. And I think under those conditions, they felt perfectly legitimate characterizing everything happening in Internet radio as trespass, rather than as yet another form of broadcasting, and no different in kind from over-the-air broadcast, except in a very positive sense in that it was somewhat interactive. It was all about characterization, and the MCA set up some of that characterization. But the CARP took it the rest of the way, you know, led by the nose, by the RIAA, and with little opposition from the people they let into the hearings. You know, as Deborah Proctor at WCPE in North Carolina pointed out, you know, even big, legitimate, 100,000-watt classical stations in a better than mid market couldn't get into the talk on the table. They couldn't do it. They were turned away, and they had plenty of good things to say. And they didn't have the political clout to fight the deal either. They couldn't afford the lawyers to go in and say, wait a minute. You know, so the people lost. But the game's not over.
Yeah, well, yeah. There's no question that this was a major two-fork screw job by two industries. There's no question in my mind, and I think most everybody else's mind, that both the recording industry of America was very complicit and cooperative with the majority of the broadcasting industry, because they both came out winners.
Someone needs to start enforcing the RICO statutes and locking some of these sons of a bitches in jail. That's all I can say. This is highly illegal. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, the whole thing is just smells.
Unfortunately, what they did was legal.
I know. Oh, yeah, with the Ayola thing too, right? Yeah, that was legal.
You know, we've got the Librarian of Congress, okay, who probably is not, you know, as another one of our friends has told us in other conversations. You know, it isn't that these people in Congress or in the regulatory bodies are stupid or even ill-informed. They're mostly partially informed.
Or maybe they're just mostly paid off.
It's unlikely. I think what happened, however, is it's quite clear that something happened between late May and late June that that changed the mind of the Librarian of Congress. And somebody got to that guy somehow. You know, there wasn't even the least bit of spin warning us of what was going to come down.
Maybe it was Jack Valenti and his thugs.
Possibly. I'm just sure that Hillary Rosen was all over this thing somehow. It wasn't Jack. He's not that good. Hillary Rosen is really, really good at what she does. There's no doubt about it. She is really good. And
evil.
Yeah, she's definitely formidable. I mean, and her position, as she said at the PC Forum a while back, was earlier this year, is enforcement. You know, that's where she's coming from. She's a cop.
Yep.
She comes on as a cop.
And,
like,
yeah, at least she doesn't hide anything.
No, she's all out there. There's nothing.
At least she's not like Jack Valenti, who pretends like he's some altruistic doing favors for the world.
Well, I think they're both, you know, effective at what they do, and they're both pretty public, and I'm sure they both twist arms in the back as well. The difference is that, quite frankly, you know, Jack Valenti is older and less credible, I think, in many cases than she is. She's younger. She's has a lot of energy. She's very involved, and she's very, very, very effective. Not to take anything away from Valenti, but this is a major score for the RIAA.
Absolutely is. We're going to have to go to war. I will be, during the course of the next 2 weeks, drafting up a declaration of war against the RIAA.
Let's see, we got the hitman out for the president of Microsoft.
And,
yeah, well, we got to get the hitman out for Jack Valenti and Hillary Rosen.
probably.
Put the hit out on them, guys.
Probably so.
Make sure that they get they pay legally for this.
Well, we are up to the 9 o'clock hour. In fact, we're a few minutes over. So does anybody on the panel have something quick that they want to wrap up on the CARP issue? We can continue this, though, at a later date. I'll just go around the panel. Russ, is there something you'd like to chime in with?
No, I think this has come out pretty much the way it's got to be.
Yep. Okay. Arnie?
No, I pretty much have said what I thought.
Doc?
Yeah, I think, you know, the only thing is just, you know, keep checking back at the Linux Journal site at some point. I'll have something long up about this thing.
Yeah. Okay, well, Kevin, do you have anything?
Yeah, looks like a really good time to invest in Canadian webcasting companies.
Yeah. Well, going offshore is a big thing here. But some of the people elsewhere, you know, are concerned as well, so.
Well, wait a minute. Doesn't RIAA have an international body just like the Motion Picture Association does?
Yeah,
but
the Copyright Office.
Not all countries observe it. Mm.
Well, I mean, Canada's pretty chummy with the United States. I would think that they would.
Yeah. A lot of people are talking about going offshore with this thing, but if you're still a U.S. resident, you're, you know, you can be found and the rest of it, so.
Yep.
I mean, it's possible some of these stations will get picked up by other people. I mean, maybe Soma FM will suddenly show up as, you know, something out of France. I have no idea.
La Soma.
Yeah.
Yeah, just it's irony. Back when, Doc, when we were young, everybody else on the show is too young for this, but back when we were young, actually when I was just a young pup, the hot radio stations in the country were the Mexican radio stations. And you could pick
XCR, XCR, whatever.
XCRF. In the middle of the country, they were. In the Northeast, we couldn't get them. But, yeah.
But,
I could get them in Detroit. I could get XCRF in Detroit.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really wild. During the daytime, we could pick up Wolfman Jack.
Yeah.
And at night, when WLS became a clear channel station, at night, of course, you couldn't hear anything except WLS at night. But, during the daytime, we got all kinds of Mexican radio stations that were all really programmed for the United States because they didn't have the same legal ramifications that the broadcasting industry does today. So it's ironic that it looks like we're heading back.
Well, here's another irony, and one of the stations, I forget which one. Last night I was literally going down through on one of the sites that has a list of stations. I was going down and this one site, all they were broadcasting was a letter to listeners that was read by a disc jockey named Peter Tripp, apologizing for the end of this. Peter Tripp, the original Peter Tripp, was a very famous disc jockey from the early 60s at WMGM in New York and later on various West Coast stations, was one of the three men I admire most, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, who caught the last train for the coast the day the music died in American Pie, in the American Pie song by Don McLean. And it just seemed wonderfully ironic to me that somebody using that name anyway, maybe it's his son, because he had a son named Peter as well. Peter Tripp died a couple of years ago. But somebody named Peter Tripp is reading this letter to listeners apologizing for having to kill the streams. When he was one of the guys who was implicated in the payola scandals from long ago and was essentially innocent. All those guys were fundamentally innocent. It was a false issue. And now, you know, there's a far more corrupt system in place, and the disc jockeys have no influence whatsoever. You know, it's just a weird, weird kind of Klein bottle irony, the whole thing.
Yep. Okay, well, that about wraps it up for tonight. We will be back in 2 weeks. We will not be here. There will be an archive of this show from tonight. It will be the only archive. A lot of people have been asking us, why can't we just edit the archives and put them back up? Well, there's two reasons why we can't edit the archives and put them back up. Number one is it would take a real lot of work. The other is, if we edit the archives and put them back up, that would imply that we removed something that had copywritten value to it. So from a legal standpoint, folks, we're sorry, but until CARP is overturned, our archives of our five-year history of this show are off the air permanently until this thing goes away, if it goes away. We're sorry to do that. We didn't want to do it, but we have no choice. That's just the reality of the situation. So, until 2 weeks from tonight, on behalf of the whole crew here at the Linux Show, well, we're out of here.
Yes, you too can sponsor the Linux Show. Here's an example.